Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar discussing the use and decline of injunctive relief in patent cases. Speaking on this panel today, we have Professor Jonathan Barnett of University of Southern California Law School, Professor Thomas Cotter of University of Minnesota Law School, hopefully being joined by Nick Matich of McCool Smith, and the Honorable Paul Michel. As our moderator, we're joined by Jeffrey Depp, who is a policy consultant at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Near the end of the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Jeff, thank you for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thanks, Edie. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning to this FedSoc forum entitled Patent Owners in the Soup, No Injunction for You. We created a little, for the Seinfeld fans in the audience, we created a little spoof on one of the show's famous characters. And if you're interested in seeing that, let us know. We can share that with you, trying to just bring a little bit of levity to this otherwise extremely serious topic. So again, we thank you for being here. We thank our august panel that's here. I'm just going to introduce them a little bit more briefly so that we can get on to the discussion. But as Edie said, we have with us today Professor Thomas Cotter from the University of Minnesota Law School. He's obviously an intellectual property and antitrust law and economics expert, but what we're really looking forward to his perspective today is as he is a remedies expert, which is quite apropos for the discussion here. We also have Judge Paul Michel, former chief judge of the Federal Circuit, was on the on the court from 1988 to 2010, where he retired to lend his voice to the ongoing and all important policy debate. And it's interesting to note that Judge Michel was on the original Federal Circuit panel that heard the eBay case back in 2005. So we're very excited to have him here and for his unique insights on this issue. Next, we have Professor Jonathan Barnett from the University of Southern California, Gould School of Law. Jonathan is as well an intellectual property expert. He's also an expert in antitrust law and economics. We're particularly interested in his insights today as he's also considered an innovation policy and strategy expert, as the result of eBay and the impact on injunctions has really had a significant impact on patent owners and how they move forward in the marketplace. We will expect to have very soon our fourth panelist, Nick Matich. He is brings our litigator perspective today. He is a principal from McCool Smith. He was former acting general counsel at the USPTO and has a wealth of experience in the intellectual property sphere, representing clients in multiple litigation matters with involving life sciences and big tech. So we're very anxious to have Nick join us and share his insights. So again, without further ado, what we're going to do today is we're going to spend a little bit of time with, talking about the case itself with a little bit of background. We have a large audience here today, and thank you all for participating. And we may have some varying familiarities with the background with the case here. So we'll talk a little bit about that briefly. And then we're going to get into its impact, how it's affected patent owners in a number of different ways. And then we will finish up with a discussion of some very exciting legislation that's recently been introduced that looks to sort of address this issue. So that's sort of how we're going to go today. So again, with that, the case involved is eBay versus Merck Exchange, as you all know. And Merck Exchange, I think Merck is likely short for merchandise exchange, because again, the invention there was involved internet technology for shopping and auctioning. There's Nick. Welcome, Nick. Thank you for joining us. We're just getting started.
Great.
And So I'll talk a little bit about the case again. Merck Exchange was a startup that was unable to make its way in the world and failed, as many startups do, and attempted to license its patents going forward after it was unable to be a going concern, and was working to establish a license with eBay, and that did not result in a license, and so they ended up in court. Merck Exchange sued eBay in the Eastern District of Virginia, and the outcome of that case at the trial court level was that the patents were upheld and found infringed, and damages were awarded, and the request for an injunction was made, and the trial court denied that request. It did apply the four-factor test that ultimately came out of the Supreme Court opinion, but determined that an injunction was not warranted. The number of issues were appealed in that case. We'll focus on the injunction issue here for our purposes today. And when that was heard by the Federal Circuit, again, of which Judge Michelle was on that panel, they reversed the trial court and entered an injunction following this Federal Circuit's sort of rule at the time was that, you know, when patents were found infringed and valid, injunctions will issue, except in very exceptional circumstances. And so the Federal Circuit overruled, reversed the district court. And of course, that then was appealed to the Supreme Court. As you know, the Supreme Court took the case, was a 8-0 opinion written by Justice Thomas. Justice Alito recused, and it was a unanimous decision for the court. And basically, again, I think as most people know, the decision was that the four-factor test, shall apply in all cases where an injunction is being considered. The patent-specific rule that the Federal Circuit had developed was inappropriate, and context-specific rules coming forward, and then there were and again the Supreme Court did not necessarily have a position as to whether or not an injunction should issue in this case or any other case, but they just said that we, you know, must have this four-factor test. It must be applied in all cases. We must start from the same baseline, and we have put no thumbs on the scale for either party. We do an independent case-by-case analysis every time, and again, that was the opinion of the court. There were two important concurrences, probably two of the more important concurrences, the most talked about concurrences, certainly in patent history, one by Justice Roberts, where he joined the court's opinion, but he, as he often does, attempted to sort of walk the line and maybe thread the needle a little bit. And while he joined the court's opinion saying that there shouldn't be a patent-specific test, pointed out very succinctly and very effectively about the history of injunctions in patent cases, and that the overwhelming majority of patent cases historically, injunctions were granted. And that was the subject of his concurrence, joined by Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg. And Justice Kennedy also had a concurrence. And his concurrence basically acknowledged what the Chief Justice said, but basically said, well, Mr. Chief Justice, we're really in different times right now. Things have changed. And we have these things called non-practicing entities. And we have these patents that may or may not be so good. So that history, while interesting, it does not really apply today moving forward. And we need you to be aware of that. And that concurrence really would be sort of felt more like policy preferences. But that concurrence has carried a lot of weight, and we'll talk about that moving forward. So with that brief background, we're going to get into, we're going to bring our panelists into the discussion here. And so I'm going to start with you, Professor Cotter, our remedies expert. So how big of a change was this eBay decision, both as a remedies matter and maybe as a general policy matter?
Yeah, as a remedies matter, as a legal matter, it is fair to say that the court actually departed from tradition, although the court articulates the four factors as the traditional four-factor test. Many remedy scholars have pointed out that it was actually something of a departure from tradition. The four factors articulated in the case would be relevant factors in any given case, depending on the facts. But the way the court articulated it, saying that the plaintiff must prove the following four factors, was something of a departure from tradition. Chief Justice Roberts certainly is correct that historically courts tended to grant injunctions most of the time in patent cases to the prevailing patent owner. So as a legal matter, it was something of a departure. I do think as a matter of policy, there is much to be said for the eBay approach, and maybe we can get into that later, you know, whatever you would like. But as a legal matter, it was something of a change.
Thank you. Judge Michelle, your thoughts on how big of a change was the eBay decision?
Well, it was a tsunami and patent practice and litigation. It totally changed the pattern that had existed beforehand, and it had enormous downstream effects, so that injunctions became almost impossible for non-manufacturers, and that's a large group of different types of actors, including universities, engineering firms, hospitals, and so on. Those entities historically have tended to be unusually innovative and important. They've tended to take bigger risks than large companies normally feel comfortable taking. And they're very dependent on patents in order to have some leverage when the smaller company is suing some super giant, like, let's say, Apple. And that balance of forces was totally upended as a practical matter by the aftermath of the eBay decision. Ironically, the decision itself really didn't do more than what Professor Cotter says. But over time, the minority concurrence penned by Justice Kennedy effectively became the holding of the case, even though it was not the holding of the eight justices in the majority opinion. But as implemented by the lower courts, including the Federal Circuit, it became the law. And I think it is the biggest single problem in patent law and practice today, even more fateful and more harmful than the mess of eligibility law or alleged abuses of the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, or the use of so-called common sense to skew obviousness analysis under Section 103 and other ills. So to me, it's the biggest problem in patent law, and it definitely needs to be fixed. And I find it quite distressing that not only was it based on a false sense of what the historical practice was, but it was also based on a false description of what the Federal Circuit doctrine was. The Supreme Court was told in very aggressive terms that the Federal Circuit followed a, quote, automatic injunction rule, end quote. That was never the case. It was always a weighing test of different factors in the given case, just as Professor Cotter says. So the court scrambled the history and was basically lied to by the advocates, or enough of them to get the point across, which I find really bizarre and distressing. And I think that the Kennedy concurrence sort of took on a life of its own, and every phrase and bit of dicta in this minority concurrence became enshrined as if it was in the Constitution itself, which, of course, it's not. The Constitution promises, I would say, I don't think that's an overstatement, it doesn't guarantee, but it promises exclusive rights to patent owners. The right to exclude is the essence of the patent right. And the patent statute itself also refers to injunctions as being available where infringement has been proven, particularly. It should be available in appropriate cases even before trial. But after trial, when a patent has been viewed as not shown to be invalid and is shown to be infringed, the normal remedy always was and should be today that an injunction will issue. And that corrects the excess leverage that bigger companies otherwise have that's an inappropriate and harmful leverage. And, you know, the most important thing is not what judges say or even what professors say or practitioners, all represented here by people I like and know and admire. The most important objects, targets of the patent system are actually people who manage money, CEOs of companies, heads of venture capitalist firms, and the like, because they make decisions about making investments or not making investments, bringing out new products, doing new research or not doing it. And if the calculus of risk is too high, they tend not to do it, which is perfectly rational. So what has happened is venture capital for what I'll call real technology has tended to dry up in recent years. Venture capital that used to be spent almost entirely in the United States after being generated here is now 50% spent abroad. And abroad, virtually every rival jurisdiction has injunctions as the routine remedy after trial. The European countries do. The major Asian countries do, even China does. The U.S. is the sole outlier, which I think in a global economy of high competition is extremely harmful to the United States. So we have a tremendous problem, and the harms keep mounting. Now, of course, economics are so complicated because there are many, many, many factors that drive total investment decisions and so forth. But there's a lot of evidence, including by other professors, including Mark Schultz and David Taylor and Professor Barnett and others, empirical evidence, and also by economists, academic economists, including Christina Acri, that shows that injunctions are now very rare, particularly for non-manufacturers, and rarer than before, even for manufacturers. And this has completely upended the whole incentive system that is at the heart of the patent law. So I consider it a big problem.
Yeah, thank you, Judge. That's great. And we're going to revisit some of that when we get into the impact section. So thank you for teeing that up for us. Nick, I'm going to turn to you as the litigator in the group. You know, talk to us. How big of a change was it? Do you agree with Judge Michelle that it is the most important, even with respect to, you know, issues at the PTAB and subject matter eligibility? And also talk to us maybe about what drove this result. You know, was it, you know, issues with judicial philosophy or thoughts about equitable relief or the patent system, or, you know, just give us your thoughts.
Yeah, I agree very much with what Judge Michelle just said. And I think that one of the traditional justifications for injunctions, not just in the patent system or for patent rights, but in general in the legal system, is cases where it's hard to prove the amount of damages at issue. And what we've seen since eBay is patent owners obviously can't get an injunction, so they're left to prove damages. And then the Federal Circuit has become notorious for reversing damages models because, unsurprisingly, it's hard to prove damages in a patent case. Every valid patent is by definition unique. And so finding the right royalty rate for it is not something that you can easily do with economists. In every patent case, half the case turns out to be a battle of PhD economists or MBA types or accountants arguing about what the patent is worth. And the lack of injunctions also hurts the data that those folks would use to make those evaluations, because theoretically, the reasonable royalty is what a reasonable business person faced with the option of using some non-infringing option versus using the technology covered by the patent, what would they pick? And now that they're never actually put to that choice, it's very hard to develop good economic evidence of what a person would do. And it ends up being, you know, often very speculative, and that's why you have the Federal Circuit reversing damages models so frequently. So what you have is a situation where the patent owner often can't get an injunction, and then often can't get damages either, and or, you know, has to do a retrial on damages. And it just makes the availability of any kind of remedy much more difficult for a patent owner.
Thank you, Nick. That's fantastic. Professor Barnett, to you, sort of to wrap up this introductory section, give us your thoughts again on these questions. How big of a change was it? What drove it? And was it a change for the better?
Yeah, I think to understand the eBay decision, you need to go back in time roughly 6 months prior to that decision. I remember I was an associate at a New York law firm at the time. And about 6 months prior to that, everyone was talking about how the BlackBerry network might go down because of a patent dispute, NTPV RIM. So the reason I want to take us back there is because the judges live in the real world just like we do. They're watching the news, and all of a sudden, a fairly esoteric area of law, namely patent law or patent litigation, was in the news. And the conversation, I think if you go back to that time, I have a book coming out and that I cover this, became a very strong anti-patent narrative. The patent troll caricature dominated the debate. That's what I think drove the Kennedy concurrence, and what drove, more importantly, the fact that the lower courts, as Judge Michelle was pointing out, effectively have treated the Kennedy concurrence as if it was the majority opinion. The reason the eBay decision is so important is really for two reasons. If we view the patent system as a type of property right system, the essence of a property right is the right to exclude. And when you start to move away from that, you're moving closer to more of an administrative regulatory type system where the courts are pricing out the assets. But courts are never as good as markets at pricing out the assets. And as Nick was pointing out, what happens is you get a vicious cycle where they're trying to figure out the comparable licenses to determine the royalties, but the royalties they're observing in the real world are already distorted by the fact that for many categories of patent owners, an injunction is not out there. The last thing I want to point out is that as the eBay jurisprudence has developed, what we've seen, two things. There's a great study by Chris Seaman that came out about 7 years after eBay, and he shows empirically how the Kennedy concurrence dominated. Basically, if you're a non-practicing entity, and we can discuss how that's defined, you're not getting an injunction after eBay. But the other key development to point out is that what's even happened after that period is that when we have patent disputes where the patent is covering a component of a larger product system, okay, that's the other thing that's what the BlackBerry litigation is about. It's not just a so-called MPE, it's a component of a larger product system. There we see courts denying injunctions, and then you start to capture operational companies, and the eBay effect starts to capture very large portions of the tech economy, because basically any tech product is multi-component. So that's how I view the decision, its background, why it's been so important.
Yeah, and I would just like add on to that. I think that the traditional injunction analysis actually takes care of the BlackBerry problem Professor Barnett is referring to, because Kennedy had a fair point that you don't want to take down some larger system because of some small component within it. But that's why in equitable circumstances, courts are supposed to weigh those factors. And you could do things like delay the injunction to give the infringer an opportunity to design around it, come up with a different component, or take a license. And if it turns out that the invention really is so valuable that there's no way to run the BlackBerry network without it, well, then maybe BlackBerry should be paying a hefty license fee. But on the other hand, if it is a truly minor component, that could be substituted out with something else, then like, again, the injunction isn't going to be such a big deal if there's time for the operator to design around it or take a license or swap out the product, because they'll do that rather than pay whatever fee that the patent owner is demanding, or the patent owner will decrease its, you know, asking price.
Thank you, Nick. So yeah, so again, great discussion on the case and the outcome. I want to give a shout out. If you're interested, we couldn't only touch the surface here. If you're interested in more in-depth review of this case, I would refer you to some great scholarship by Judge Ryan Holt. He did when he was a law professor back in 2015. A law review article really takes the case from soup to nuts, and lots of really sort of interesting nuances. And as law review article goes, it's a page turner. If you're interested in this case, he walks you through it from soup to nuts. A lot of great insights, and I would highly recommend for further read to take a look at that article again from Judge Holt back in 2015. So now we're going to move to the next section. I think we've made it quite clear that as a result of the case, you know, the number of injunctions clearly has gone down. But let's try to to drill down to that a little bit further. Judge Michelle, you sort of let us off. You teed this up for us. I'm going to come back to you. What has been the impact on innovation in the United States, technology commercialization, the economic impact of this reduction in injunctions? Are we seeing more settlements? Are fewer injunctions even being sought? Just talk to us about all of those aspects of the eBay decision.
Well, you mentioned settlements, which is a very important part of commercial litigation, including patent litigation. In my experience, settlements between the parties are always better than adjudications by a judge or a jury or both. The business leaders are in the best position to know the market forces present and future and how to value things. So settlements are highly desirable. In the foreign jurisdictions, and all of them except us, when there is a finding of infringement, an injunction almost always promptly issues. And the result is the parties settle. And they settle on terms that I maintain are fairer and more in line with market value than what courts can do. In the U.S., settlements are going down, just like investment in real technology is going down, even though VC totals are higher than before, much higher. But they're going into things like social media, making movies, casinos, hospitality, building hotels, not into real technology the way they were before. And that's one of the reasons. There are others too, because economics are complicated. But it's one of the reasons why China is now rated as ahead of the U.S. in 37 out of the 44 advanced technologies of the 21st century. This is something that our country cannot live with. But that's the reality. You can quibble with that study like any other study. It was done by an Australian think tank and funded partly by our State Department. But aside from, marginal definitional disputes, it's clear that our innovation, particularly by startups and smaller businesses, is flagging. A lot of businesses are failing. I'm on the board of directors of a tech transfer operation at the University of Virginia, where I went to law school. And they're having a terrible time recently because of the unavailability of injunctions, the impossibility of getting settlements, they're not able to get people interested in taking licenses to commercialize the products covered by their patents because there are no strong remedies available anymore. So it's hurting the whole system, and there's proof of it left, right, and center.
Thank you, Judge. Professor Carter, as our law and economics expert, What in your opinion has been the economic impact of post eBay? Have there been studies and walk us through some of that, if you will.
Yeah, so I will respectfully disagree to some degree with my other fellow panelists. As a matter of economic theory, injunctions have various benefits, including spurring negotiations and reducing the need for courts to set damages. But there are also social costs. And I think one of those costs particularly does arise in the complex product world, which characterizes probably most of our innovation today. Any given product may embody hundreds or thousands of patents. And so if the owner of one single patent can demand an injunction, can threaten an injunction against a practicing entity, that gives the patent owner enormous leverage to extract a royalty that can exceed the economic value of the innovation. That's the holdup phenomenon discussed in the economics literature. The BlackBerry case, I think, is one example of that. When and if holdup occurs, it's bad for consumers. It means we're paying more than we should for innovation. It's bad for innovation. It's bad for startups. And so I think we do need a safety valve, and eBay, for whatever defects one might find in it, does provide some degree of safety. As a matter of empirical evidence, I'm aware of at least three peer-reviewed empirical studies by economists, Mezzanotte, Simcoe, Christian Helmers, and Brian Love is a law professor, but he does a lot of empirical work. And these studies actually, they use the econometric technique of difference in differences to try to tease out possible causal relations. And they found no empirical support for the proposition that eBay was having a negative impact on U.S. innovation. In fact, the latter two studies actually found a marginally positive impact. So as an empirical matter, I think eBay actually has probably on balance been beneficial.
I find that kind of surprising, because if you talk to people in the real world, they don't talk about hold up. They talk about hold out being the pervasive phenomenon where the big companies refuse to take a license. And in terms of the quandary of a manufacturing company with a big complex product covered by many different patents, they have a lot of options. It's not the case that it's going to shut down their business and take their product off the market. It's the case, as Nick Mattish pointed out, that they may need to swap out a product or design around or take a license. And the companies involved are so wealthy. They have more in the bank than most countries generate in their whole economy in a year. So the idea that they're being bled white by nasty trolls threatening injunctions and hijacking them to get outrageous royalty rates and awards is just fiction. From my perspective, based on what people in real litigation and real business circles say, and I don't care too much what some economists say, because the real world evidence is, in my view, overwhelming.
Thanks, Judge. Sure. Go ahead, Professor.
And again, with all due respect, I also think we do need to be concerned, though, about patent trolls, patent assertion entities, which can have a negative impact on startup companies. Again, there are empirical studies substantiating that. And again, eBay gives us a way of dealing with that. And I would also note just the comparative law issue that Judge Michelle and others talked about. It's true that other countries routinely grant injunctions to the prevailing patent owner. That is true even in the other common law countries, such as the UK and Canada. But I would note they have other mechanisms for controlling patent trolling, among them mandatory fee shifting to the prevailing party, much less extensive discovery. They have no jury trial. So there are features of the US system that might demand something like eBay in order to keep patent assertion entities from harming startups and ultimately harming consumers.
The trouble I have with that is that patent assertion entities, or patent trolls, or non-practicing entities, or however you want to label them, are a broad class. If they have invalid patents, or the patents aren't even infringed, and suits are being filed anyway, that's a frivolous lawsuit, and judges can and do punish frivolous lawsuits with serious sanctions. So the idea that added protections are needed, I think, is questionable.
Thank you, Judge. Professor Barnett, I want to bring you into the conversation here. We had to help us reconcile, you know, the academic literature versus the real world here. What are your thoughts on the sort of the economic impact that we're seeing on technology, innovation, commercialization since eBay?
Yeah, you know, I think eBay addresses the issue that I'd raised before, and Professor Cotter brought in the term that a lot of law professors use, which is patent hold up, right? And let's assume for the moment, just for the sake of argument, that abuse of the patent litigation system by NPEs is some material portion of litigation. We're going to just assume for the sake of argument that's true. The question then is the remedy in eBay, is the solution to the problem in eBay the right solution? And I would venture the argument that the solution that was adopted by the court, or again, to really be precise, by the lower courts in their application of eBay, was too blunt for this particular problem, right? We can take any area of civil litigation. We could take class action litigation. I think everyone will agree that some portion of class action litigation is abusive and some other portion is meritorious, right? And we can say the same thing about patent infringement suits. But to pull out the property right aspect of the patent system is to choose your bluntest instrument. As Judge Michel was pointing out, in patent infringement litigation, as in all areas of federal civil litigation, there are a number of tools that courts have at their disposal to punish and therefore to deter abuse of the litigation process. A critique of eBay is that by choosing the harshest possible solution, they may have deterred patent hold up, but they have virtually by necessity created patent hold out. And that creates an uneven playing field when the accused infringer has far more litigation resources than the patent owner. And it gives rise to another cost. It distorts the business models that are viable in tech markets. When you no longer have a credible threat of an injunction, even if you are a non-abusive, you have a good patent suit, it is no longer rational for any well-resourced defendant to take the license. Their best strategy is to drag you in court, and that makes that business model uninvestable. What we have is a patent system today that tends to favor platform-based business models, and it tends to disfavor licensing-based business models. And there's nothing in the economic literature that tells us that that is a good policy choice, to my knowledge.
Excellent, thank you. Nick, wrap us up here in this section here. As a litigator, someone who represents clients, actual parties to these disputes, your thoughts as to the real world economic impact that we're seeing post eBay.
You're muted, Nick.
You're on mute. Sorry, I 100% agree with what Professor Barnett just said. It does create the incentive to litigate, because even if a patent owner comes to you with a reasonable license offer, say they say, license my patent for $100, and we can all agree that that is reasonable, then the incentive for the defendant, and the clearly rational thing to do for the defendant, is say, well, I'm going to impose $50 of litigation costs on you. How would you give me a license for $75? So then the patent owner is left without a reasonable license, and then a reasonable compensation. And then the next guy, when he goes to try to license somebody else, is going to say, well, clearly the reasonable royalty is $75. That's what you licensed the last guy at. I'm going to also impose $50 $1,000 of litigation costs on you. How about you give me a license for $50? And you end up with a downward, you end up with a downward spiral. And I guess I'm curious, Professor Cotter, how do you respond, or sort of what's your view on why it wouldn't be sufficient to, once a patent has been finally adjudicated to be valid and infringed, to say, to address the sort of system, the eBay, or not the eBay, the BlackBerry problem, to say, all right, BlackBerry or RIM, you've got 6 months to like get on to either take a license or figure out how to fix your system. And obviously the 6 months would depend on whatever evidence there was about how long it would take to design around.
Nick, I think that's a very good point. I think courts in the U.S. actually ought to be more receptive to what you're describing, which is sometimes referred to as a tailored injunction or something along those lines. We do see courts occasionally staying injunctive relief for a period of time to enable design around. And I think that is often a very good compromise solution and allows some of the benefits of injunctive relief in the long run without imposing such costs. But I think that is something courts already can do, perhaps should do more than they are, but it easily can fit within the current eBay framework.
I mean, I agree with you. And the problem with eBay is not so much eBay, but I think what came after eBay and reading the Kennedy concurrence as the holding, because I don't think, I agree with you, I don't think eBay is inconsistent with that regime. I think that regime is actually closer to what the Federal Circuit was doing previously, and certainly what general equitable practice is, you know, more broadly inside and outside of the patent system. But the problem I have with eBay is that it's been read, you know, the Supreme Court thought they were getting rid of one bright line rule and advertently or inadvertently created the opposite bright line rule.
Thank you, Nick. That's terrific. Okay. So, yeah, so we're going to now move into the last portion of our discussion here. But again, I will refer you to some, if you're interested in further reading on the, you know, the impact of eBay, there are some very recent scholarship that I will call to your attention by Professor Christina Akri from Colorado College. She's done a new analysis on the injunctive relief in patent cases, the impact on eBay. And so I would encourage you to look that up and review her work. Fascinating, you know, updated scholarship on the impact of eBay. So we are moving again to our last portion of the program here. Late in July, some legislation was introduced in both the House and the Senate, bipartisan legislation in both houses, called the Restore Act. And the Restore Act attempts to, again, assuming that, you know, this reduction in injunctions, what we talked about, is the problem that it is. This legislation, this bill, attempts to remedy that, attempts to fix that, attempts to correct this problem. And so, again, I'm going to go to you first, Judge Michelle. So talk to us about the Restore Act. How does it work? And you know, give us your thoughts.
The act, if passed, would create a presumption that an injunction should issue after the patent has been declared not invalid and infringed. But it is a rebuttable presumption, of course, as it would have to be. And so, for example, if I'm the defendant and I can show that the injunction would totally destroy my business and I'd have to fire all my employees and all my stockholders would be bankrupt in terms of their ownership of my stock, the judge doesn't have to issue an injunction. We talked earlier about delayed issuance of injunctions. But remember, the ultimate safety valve to prevent some horrible, destructive injustice is to simply deny the injunction on that basis. And judges are quite quick to do that. So it seems to me the real point of the shift of the burden is if the hardship on the accused infringer, now adjudicated infringer, is so terrible, who's better able to prove that? The infringer himself, that company. So it puts the burden of putting new facts on the scale on the right party. The pat donor is not in a good position to judge the destructive effect of the injunction. So it seems to me it's a very practical way to rebalance the scales and to create a level playing field that doesn't give giant companies, particularly platform companies, an undue advantage over everybody else, small and middle and less than behemoths, which is sort of what we have now. So it seems to me it's a good rebalancing. And I'm not fond of the way Congress uses clever, maybe clever, depends on your viewpoint, ways of naming bills. But this bill actually, it makes sense to call it the Restore Act, because before the lower courts overextended the Kennedy concurrence, everything was fine in the injunction world. And what the bill would do is to put us back to the pre-eBay implementation timeframe. And that was a time of enormous innovation in America, the 80s, the 90s and beyond. I would think we would want to get back to that level of innovation for all sorts of reasons. So it looks to me like it's a very good solution. And it doesn't really dictate the result. It just dictates who has to prove what.
So you said that it does restore the state of the law to what it was before eBay. Is that true? Does it abrogate eBay expressly, or how does it do that?
It doesn't even mention eBay. It just creates new law. Remember, the patent system in America is essentially a statutory system. It's not a common law system. But the Supreme Court on many issues has treated it as if it's predominantly a common law system, and they get to decide everything, or lower court judges the same. It seems to me that it's entirely appropriate for Congress to rebalance an imbalance and restore things to a status quo ante by passing legislation. This bill is essentially one sentence long. It's not too complicated for anybody, including members of Congress and their staff. All it does is allow there to be a fair airing of potential injustices by those best able to prove the injustice. Seems to me to be exactly the right thing to do, and I hope they pass it.
Interesting. Now, you know, as I read the legislation, it talks that the presumption should be that the court should grant a permanent injunction, you know, but it seems that the test that the Federal Circuit used to apply pre-eBay was more of a will or a shall. What do you think is going on there? Is that a concern, or you know, will that be an issue? Will that allow courts to, you know, avoid giving injunctive relief as they are at present?
Of course, it doesn't dictate the outcome in any particular case or overall. It just creates who has to prove what, which seems to me entirely beneficial. And judges are quick to recognize excess harm. Nobody wants to destroy a company unnecessarily. And of course, the bill allows for injunctions when they are to be issued to be delayed or tailored in certain ways, which judges also are empowered to do and frequently do, and properly so. So it seems to me the bill fixes the imbalance without creating imbalance in the other direction.
Fantastic. Thank you. Nick, as a litigator, how does the Restore Act, how do you feel that will impact your work as a litigator, your clients? Do you think they'll like this language? Will they feel more comfortable engaging in partnerships to commercialize new technologies with something like this in place?
So I agree with what Judge Michelle just said. I would add that, I mean, one of the issues with the post eBay world is that essentially courts have said, if you have a willingness to license your technology, then money is a sufficient remedy for you. And so I do have concern about, you know, how the court or how courts would interpret the Restore Act in that regard, and whether or not if the accused infringer comes forward and says with evidence that's pretty easy to get that, you know, oh, this this patent owner has shown a willingness to license. And so therefore the no injunction should issue because we can pay them we can pay them damages. The issue is that what would those damages be? And are they what the patent owner has been demanding else they get an injunction? I mean, like to take it in the real estate context, we still have, there are people that are willing to rent out their real estate, but we don't say no evictions because they're willing to take money in exchange for the use of their property right. If it's going to remain a property regime, then the owner of the property gets to set what the rent is. And if you don't want to pay the rent, then you got to find different property.
Interesting. You talked about licensing there in first part of your remarks. I note that the language is sort of exclusively focused on the patent owner. Does it concern you that there's no reference to an exclusive licensee that would be entitled to this rebuttable presumption? Is that going to be a concern, do you think?
I don't think so. I think there's a good chance that courts would end up interpreting it to cover the exclusive licensee because that's how they have standing to begin with. If you truly are the exclusive licensee, then you're probably going to be able to get the patent owner to join you if necessary to get an injunction. And then also, this isn't 100%, this isn't the case across the board, but exclusive licensees tend to arise in areas where you don't have a problem getting injunctive relief, like in the pharmaceutical space where you have like I imagine what you might be thinking of is like a university exclusively licensing to a drug company. And that's a case where eBay has not been as much of an issue as in the high tech semiconductor computer software sorts of spaces.
Excellent. Thank you. Professor Barnett, yeah, your thoughts on the Restore Act. One other question that comes to mind for me, you know, specifically is that, does it need to reference, you know, make specific, call specific attention to NPEs to make sure that they get the rebuttable presumption, given the problems that we've had post eBay and what we talked about earlier, how NPEs seems to be suffering the greatest reduction or elimination in their ability to get an injunction.
Yeah, so I would just say two things. One, just to clarify for the audience, this is in no way a radical proposal. All that it's doing, as Judge Michelle was pointing out, as the title of the legislation or the acronym of the legislation suggests, it's just restoring the patent law, not just to the way it was in 2006, but there's a recent article by Adam Mossop that shows this. I think it's quite widely agreed, but he demonstrates it to the nth detail. At least since the late 19th century, this has been the way patent litigation has operated. And why is that the case? Because the patent system in the United States has historically been viewed as a type of property rights system. So it's not a radical change. The exact, very, very similar change was made to the Trademark Act a few years ago, specifically to address the adoption by some courts of eBay or eBay type logic in trademark cases. As for specifically addressing NPEs, I personally would not be partial to that because the point of a property rights view of the patent system is that it is a business model agnostic, right? And that's really the key virtue of the legislation as it's currently proposed. If it were implemented rigorously by the courts. And I think there is some concern that it may not be, that that should could be interpreted in different ways. But if it were interpreted rigorously, it would restore the property rights baseline to tech markets in which patents are used widely. And markets would simply choose and develop the variety of business models that they're most efficient. Markets are going to discover the most efficient business model. Courts and regulators, we have no idea which business model suits every particular industry and technology.
Jeff, just as a legal matter, in terms of patent system being essentially a property system, the Patent Act itself specifies that patents, quote, shall have the attributes of personal property. So it's Congress telling us all that this is a property type system.
Yeah, I agree with Professor Barnett that it should be, the Patent Act and the Restore Act are properly business model agnostic. It's a question of there shouldn't be special treatment one way or the other for an NPE, either for or against. And to underscore the non-radicality of the proposal, this isn't just what existed prior to the, you know, in the 19th century through the 20th century for patents. It's what currently exists for all property rights regimes of, you know, property of whatever species.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's great. And again, thank you, Professor Barnett, for highlighting some that great new scholarship by Professor Mossoff. Really sort of validates what Justice Roberts wrote in his concurrence about the history of injunctive relief for patent cases. And it, I think it really sets up nicely this sort of macro approach, if you will, to getting an injunction rather than focusing on the four factors. Because again, Professor Mossoff shows that this four factor test didn't exist historically. And again, I would encourage folks who are interested to take a look at his work. It's fascinating. Now, in the last few minutes, I'm going to come to our remedies expert to wrap us up here. Professor Cotter, well, we heard a little bit about the Trademark Modernization Act and, you know, how it is affected. And that got me thinking, and I wanted you to just try to address this specifically if you can. Preliminary injunctions. In that modification to the Lanham Act for trademark owners, there was a specific reference to preliminary injunctive relief. That doesn't appear here in the Restore Act. And I know a lot of small companies, startups, universities, you know, are very concerned, you know, about or cash strapped, and needing and really like to have the opportunity to get preliminary injunctions. So, you know, talk to us again generally about your thoughts about the Restore Act and that particular issue.
Yeah, so I actually think the amendment to the Lanham Act makes sense because a likelihood of confusion, or at least a likelihood of success on proving confusion, almost by definition means that there is going to be irreparable harm to the trademark owner and to consumers. So the rebuttable presumption makes sense in that context. If I was addressing this issue in patent law the day after eBay came out, I'd say probably we'd want the same rebuttable presumption in patent law. But again, I'll just say that my own view is that looking at the empirical evidence from the last 16, 17, 18 years, I don't think eBay is harming innovation. If anything, it may be having a marginally positive effect. And my advice would be to leave it alone.
Thank you. Okay, great. Well, we have one question here from the two questions from the audience. So I'll take I'll throw this out to the group. Is the consideration of the public interest in the context of this has a question about for our antitrust scholars. With the neo-Brandeisian trend at the FTC, how do we expect courts to weigh the antitrust concerns on the public interest prong of the test? Obviously, this assumes that the Restore Act does not become law. Anyone want to volunteer to take that?
I guess I would say I don't think that the courts are going to follow the neo-Brandeisian approach, and I think that's for the better that they don't. I don't think that would have much effect in terms of patent law.
Very good. Okay. Well, I think that, again, we're just about at the hour, so I'll just take the final few seconds to, again, thank everyone for participating and on this August Thursday morning. But most importantly, I want to thank our august panel for their time and their wonderful insights on this all-important issue. And I'll turn it back over to you, Edie, for a wrap.
Yes, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Professor Barnett, Professor Cotter, Nicholas, and Judge Michelle for speaking, and to Jeff for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise today. Thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.